are listening to KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. This is the Kenai Conversation. I'm Jenny Nyman. Shauna Loshbow, a Kenai Peninsula historian who has lived various places on the Kenai Peninsula off and on since 1981, was at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center November 13th, presenting her research project, The Brief Awkward History of Fort Kenai. We're going to share that presentation later this hour, but first we have the historian herself in the studio. Shauna, thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. And hello, Kenai.
And thanks for giving your presentation a fun title. That's always appreciated.
Well, when I came across the story, I thought, well, this is brief and awkward, and it's also kind of a fun story, so I really wanted to bring it back and share it with the community.
Yeah, it's always great to learn a little more about, you know, our history and a site that all of us have passed who knows how many times and our residents here in the Kenai and probably not thought too much about how that came to be there. So how did you come to get interested in this topic? How did this presentation come about?
Well, after I moved here in 1981, I discovered that I had landed in a very unusual place, and there was not an easily available little book that told the history of it, but every little tidbit that I picked up from old-timers and obscure publications was extremely interesting, and so I started delving deeper and deeper, and thus ended up getting drawn into local history and trying to do some of it myself. And in those histories, there was mention of Fort Kenai. It came at kind of a crucial time. It was right at that fulcrum moment when the United States had just purchased Alaska and the Kenai Peninsula, which had been settled by natives and exploited by Russian colonists, and all of a sudden it was part of the United States, and Fort Kenai was the first official U.S. government presence in the area. So it's kind of an important thing. And then I really ended up focusing on the topic in the wake of our 2017 local history conference that we had, marking the 150th anniversary of the U.S. purchase of Alaska. At the time when we did that conference, we put the word out that we were looking for people to come and talk about these different aspects of that transitional period. And I was really surprised that nobody stepped up to talk about Fort Kenai. We filled up the schedule with all the other things, and I don't think people noticed that there was that gap, but in my mind, it was sort of like, you know, this is an omission that should have been dealt with. And so I just kind of had my eye out to see if I could find out more about it. And I have to give credit to the archives at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. It turns out that, I don't have the exact year, but sometime circa 2019 or something, right about the time of the pandemic beginning, a family in the lower 48 donated papers to the University of Alaska archives. And it turned out that a bunch of the material related to Fort Kenai. So one day I was visiting in Fairbanks, and I was looking on the internet, thinking about going over and rootling around in the archives, and I looked up Kenai as a place name, and I was surprised to see that they had this brand new collection that had not been listed before, and that Fort Kenai was one of the keywords with it. So I contacted the archivists and asked if I could come down and look at that material, and sure enough, made an appointment. And when I went to the archives, they had gotten all these materials out, you know, a couple of boxes of things. And they told me that I was the first person who had asked about this collection and the first person who had come to actually look at it.
Wow.
And, you know, and it was kind of like, you know, when you're a kid and you open that great Christmas present, you know, what's in the box? So I started going through the box that they had with this material. Briefly, I'll describe what it was. It was items from a man named Medoram Crawford Jr. And he lived, I don't have exact dates offhand, but sort of the late 1800s was when he was active. And he was a career military officer. He attended West Point and was in the U.S. Army. And he was based out of Oregon. And his family was quite prominent in Oregon. And his father apparently was one of the original Oregon pioneers that helped get statehood. But Medoram Crawford, in his youth, he was the first Oregonian to attend West Point.
Wow.
And he was just somewhat too young to have been in the Civil War. And after he graduated from West Point, the U.S. government said, guess what? We're going to send you to Alaska that we just bought. So this was like his first posting, was to come up here. And apparently it was memorable enough that all the way in his senior years, when he was reflecting on his career, he would bring up Alaska again and again. And most of the papers that he had left to his family were about his approximately two years adventures in Alaska. So I started reading this material, and some of it was like a pretty Spartan journal about things that had gone on, and some ledger books from when he had worked as the commissary officer.
Oh, but lots of lists of salt pork, yes, and whatnot.
Well, it was interesting because the commissary, apparently one of the main things there was demand for was liquor. So there were a whole lot of things about trying to get liquor and then trying to make sure the liquor they got didn't get stolen on the way or diverted. But the thing that really ended up segueing into this story was in the collection, there were original letters that he had written to his father and other family members about, you know, and had written while he was in Alaska. And unlike the military stuff, this was not censored or approved, and was pretty amazingly candid stuff about his opinions about what he'd seen. And then also, when he was retired, he was interviewed by some newspapers in Oregon about his career, and he told these stories from the vantage of, you know, 40-plus years later of things that had happened while he was on the Kenai Peninsula. And as I read these, I just started thinking, oh my gosh, this is pretty crazy stuff, and this is really interesting. And so I decided I really needed to bring it back to the community. And it's such a fun talk. It's unusual because there's some pretty serious things that happened. It's very dramatic, and yet nobody got killed. And some of the stuff was so weird that I sort of classify it as a dark comedy.
Yeah, there's some fun anecdotes in there for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's important too, because it sort of reflects on sometimes the government or even other entities and individuals, you suddenly have a project thrust upon you, and if you are faced with a situation and you really don't have any background knowledge and you haven't had time to prepare, sometimes all kinds of strange things can ensue. So this was one of those cases.
And was the presentation solely based on those documents, or were you able to find other information that rounded it out?
I did find other information. Two major sources, I don't know if this is a spoiler alert to say, but the first half of the saga is about how when the U.S. Army, when they sent this regiment up here that was supposed to go to Kenai, they got shipwrecked on the way. And there's more information actually that's been shared in the past about the shipwreck. And there was one, not too long after the shipwreck, there was a physician who was supposed to be the regiment doctor who was on the ship. And after leaving the military and getting back not too long after the wreck, he wrote a magazine article about it for a magazine that was apparently really popular at the time that published illustrated stories from all around the country. And that particular story now is available free online because it's out of copyright. So it's possible to go on the internet and Google it and look at the engraved pictures and read that whole article.
Wow.
So that was a nice source. And then sort of bracketing the other, the contemporary history, looking back at the shipwreck, there was a fellow who used to live in Anchorage named Stephen Lloyd, and he was, I think not a professional, but very, very serious hobbyist who knew a lot, and he was a marine archaeologist interested in shipwrecks, and he located the wreck of the Torrent and did a big project with that and actually made a video about it, which was very informative. And I was able to contact Mr. Lloyd, and he was very supportive and helpful. He sent me pictures. He sent me a map that he did. He let me show his video. And so I really owe a debt of gratitude. So I think probably the two major people that I'm grateful to for this are Stephen Lloyd and the ghost of Medoram Crawford Jr.
It's a perfect name for a ghost, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And it turns out there's still quite a bit that we don't know about Fort Kenai. We don't know the layout. You haven't come across any photos of the original fort.
Yeah, so there are a couple of mysteries that are still ongoing. I haven't been able to find even any hint that anybody photographed it. You know, there were Civil War photographs, but it seems like there weren't very many photographs being taken in Alaska in the 1860s. But there apparently was a drawing or map or schematic, whatever you want to call it, showing the layout of the fort. And the late archaeologist and anthropologist Alan Boris, who taught for many years at Kenai Peninsula College here, he apparently had a copy of that drawing, but he's no longer with us, and I've talked with faculty over there, and we have not been able to relocate that. So that may be there somewhere, and we'll keep an eye out for it. And I'd also heard a rumor, I thought, that somebody had at one point made a model of the fort.
Oh.
And I thought that had been given to the little museum that's now in the visitor center in Kenai, but apparently not. So I don't know if that was a real thing or had been somehow conflated with some other model that somebody had done. But yeah, there's definitely supposed to be a schematic drawing out there of the fort. So we'll keep an eye out for that.
The research continues.
Yes, yes. And it would also be interesting to find out if any more of the people who were connected with the fort maybe had left papers with their version of some of those events. So, for example, one of the people who's fairly well known in Alaska history who was at Fort Kenai, at least for a while, is a man named Ivan Petrov. And he was a Russian immigrant who ended up doing a lot of work for the U.S. government, and a lot of that was translations. So he went back and forth between California and Alaska, and he worked for Bancroft, who wrote the first American history of Alaska. He worked for the U.S. Census Bureau, and he turned out to be a pretty controversial character, because it turned out that when he ended up being short on time for researching stuff, then he would just make up stuff to fill in the blanks. But I actually have I'm not going to name names because it's all preliminary stuff, but I have a friend and colleague I met through the Alaska Historical Society who's interested in Ivan Petrov and maybe doing a project on him.
Oh, excellent.
So we're on the lookout, too, to see what things that Petrov may have left. And then if we do read his stuff, is it true or is it not?
Oh. We will have to wait for your next research project to find out.
Yeah. Well, actually, one time in the archive in California, I did find a piece that was written by Ivan Petrov that was supposed to be about the Kenai Peninsula. It did not specifically talk about Fort Kenai, but it talked about kind of gold rush things and exploring the area, and it mentioned some of the area papers. And I got to look at that on microfilm and get a copy of that article and transcribe it, because it was all handwritten. So I have a transcript of that somewhere. And then I talked to the late Terrence Cole, who's one of Alaska's best known historians, who again is no longer with us. And I told Terrence Cole told me, well, if Ivan Petrov wrote it, do not take it as a source unless you can find independent verification of it. So,
bit of a reputation there, Ivan.
Yeah. So that's sometimes history has great stories in it, and then sometimes great stories get conflated with history. But I think with the Madoram Crawford papers and the military records of Fort Kenai, that I'm pretty sure that what I found and had in this talk are things that actually happened.
That's the bar you always, I'm sure, shoot for with a history presentation.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for bringing a slice of Kenai history to Kenai. We very much appreciate it. And thanks for being here to visit today.
Oh, my pleasure. And I continue looking for interesting Kenai Peninsula stories. And there's so many of them, I have more than a filing cabinet full of stuff to work on. And to all you people out there, yeah, you should read up about the area. It's a pretty special place.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, that is Shauna Loshbaugh, a Kenai Peninsula historian and longtime Kenai Peninsula resident. And this is her presentation on the brief, awkward history of Fort Kenai. This is the Kenai Conversation on KDLL 91.9 FM.
As everybody here knows who I am, Shauna Loshbaugh, and as I mentioned, this is actually the fourth time I've given this talk, and I think some of the people here have heard it before, so thank you for coming, and hopefully we'll have some time for some questions. And so, briefly, I'm going to talk about Fort Kenai, which turns out to be quite the saga. So I do have a script, and that's because I have some extensive quotes I want to read. So we'll start out. There's three pieces to this story. Well, it's sort of lined out here, but there's really two major adventures that happened that are both connected to Fort Kenai. So this is quite the drama. So it starts out, the Americanization of Alaska following the 1867 sale of Russian America proceeded erratically. the official U.S. government arrival was delayed and compromised by the ignorance, lack of advanced planning, and in some cases, ill luck. The Kenai Peninsula case highlights all three. Whoops, I hit the wrong button. Let's try the right button. The abrupt transfer of Alaska left the American government officials scrambling. It was Seward's big surprise to Congress, apparently. General Jefferson C. Davis, not to be confused with the deposed president of the Confederacy, was sent to Sitka in the autumn of 1867 to take command as the de facto governor. But mobilizing a credible presence in Alaska took much longer. And that was the takeover in Sitka was where they changed the flags, and that's what officially Alaska Day is that we just recently marked. So federal officials classified Alaska as Indian country and set up interim military rule. Demobilization in the wake of the Civil War and the lower 48's ongoing Indian wars shaped the plans. The U.S. Army would go north, set up forts, engage, and reduce threats to potential settlers from a largely unknown indigenous population. Because the official transfer was late in 1867, I actually shouldn't have transferred the slides there, was not until 1867, occupation beyond Sitka was deferred till the next year, 1868. So, the Military Division of the Pacific, headquartered in California under H.W. Halleck, general there, was put in charge of it. The generals planned to establish six forts associated with Russian colonial trade centers, including Kenai. The servicemen, their associates, and equipment for the new forts shipped out of San Francisco in the spring. Their lack of enthusiasm was summed up by General John C. Tidball, later sent to Kodiak to oversee the forts. He wrote to a relative, quote, "It was a sorry day for my regiment when the purchase of Alaska was made, and I wish that Seward had all the icebergs and rocks and some of the polar bears rumbling around in his old dyspeptic stomach." After a stop in Washington Territory, two companies of the 2nd Artillery sailed for South Central Alaska. The first troop, 114 men of Battery G, under Lieutenant Eli Lundy Huggins, arrived safely in Kodiak and began constructing facilities there. The other group, Battery F, under 37-year-old Brevet Captain John J. McGilvery, left Port Gamble on Puget Sound on June 11th, 1868. So two things I want to say about this slide. Does anybody here remember in the 1960s, there was a sitcom on TV called F Troop?
Yeah.
So on the Kenai Peninsula, we had our own F Troop. And this was them, Battery F. And also, McGilvery, the fortifications for World War II at Kane's Head were named after him. After checking in with the Kodiak contingent, F's chartered ship, the Torrent, entered Cook Inlet on July 8th. She carried about 150 people, McGilvery and his men, two servants, four women, apparently all wives of soldiers, and they were described as laundresses. Also 11 children, plus a ship's crew of 15, led by Captain Richard Carleton. Also aboard were mules and other livestock, plus armaments, tools, and provisions. Their mission was to establish a fort at Kenai, spelled with an A, A-Y. I should maybe call it Kenai to distinguish the two spellings. However, I'll get to that later. Three eyewitness accounts survive describing what ensued. These are McGilvery's official reports to the military authorities, an article that the battalion's medical officer at the time, W.T. Wythe, wrote for a 1872 magazine, and private papers of Lieutenant Medorum Crawford, Jr. These incoming Yankees had only the vaguest notion of where the Russians' Kenai trading post was. Confusion about the region's geography is common in historic records. Russians refer to the entire peninsula as Kenai and the water body west of it as Kenai Gulf. Every post or settlement in the basin could be called Kenai in the broadest sense. Moreover, when Halleck wrote his instructions to Davis about signing the forts, he used the name Chugachnik Gulf for Cook Inlet, a term Alaskans instead used for what we now call Kachemak Bay, or even Prince William Sound. So here, I'll just point out some of the crazy stuff here. So here you see Kenai with an A, Kenai Peninsula. And here's what, this is 1867, so this is the kind of map they're working off of. It's showing as the sites of settlement, Fort Nicholas, which is where we are right now, Fort George, which they have in the wrong place. They're showing it as being at Ninilchik when it was actually at Kisilov. Fort Resurrection over here on where Seward is now, and Alexandrovsk. Which, anybody here who doesn't know what Alexandrovsk is?
I know.
Okay. It is the modern village of Nanwalik at the tip of the peninsula. And it's, that place has had multiple names over the years. And Alexandrovsk was actually the first Russian settlement on the mainland of Alaska.
Cool.
Which a lot of people don't know. And it was the first Russian fort on the Kenai Peninsula. And here you see it says Chugachnik Gulf, Kachemak Bay. So these people didn't know where they were going. Turning into Lower Cook Inlet, Captains Carleton and McGilvery bore northeast into the sheltered waters of Kachemak Bay, which they thought was Kenai Harbor. Here is a lovely modern map estimating their adventures, their track. So they came in around here and they sailed up into Kachemak Bay and they discovered the Homer Spit. And then I'll describe, they sort of explored the area. The ship scouted for landing sites along the relatively flat north shore and promptly ran aground on the shoals by the Homer Spit, probably on July 9th. With much effort, the men dragged the torrent into deeper water, anchored there, and returned to reconnoiter the spit. That night, the soldiers caught and ate a large king crab, marveled at the lush vegetation visible on the gently sloped mainland, and rejoiced that Alaska, at least on the Kenai, was not the barren, frozen wilderness they had feared. McGilvery rejected the Homer Spit as a fort site, however, because it lacked both fresh water and timber. The next day, the crew moved the ship around the end of the spit and anchored in the upper bay, about 3 miles offshore. A longboat was dispatched to row up the north shore to find an anchorage and scope out the terrain. It couldn't get within a mile of the beach due to the shoals. That afternoon, another party was dispatched. Quote, "And after wading more than half a mile through the water, they reached land and on their return brought specimens of coal, but reported they had been unable to climb the bluff," unquote, wrote Dr. Wythe. The soldiers and sailors spent two more days exploring the north side of Kachemak Bay. They slogged along the muddy tidal flats, scaled the crumbly bluff, and bushwhacked through buggy muskegs on the Homer Bench. When McGilvery dug into the ground, remember this is July, he found traces of permafrost and nowhere any land level and dry. Wythe continued, quote, "From the deck of the ship, Kinney appeared indeed like a paradise. But, as a soldier remarked, while dripping wet, as he stumbled through the swamp, holding his musket in one hand while he fought mosquitoes with the other, I tell you, boys, this is hell," unquote. Based on what they'd seen, the rough marine chart available, and what locals had told them, the military officers and Captain Carleton all agreed to return to the southern tip of the peninsula. Near Nanwalek, the chart showed a decent anchorage known variously as English Bay or Port Graham. So it's this bay here. So they decided to go there and see if that would be the place to do a fort. On July 12th, they headed that way. After they left the lee shelter of the Homer Spit, the strong currents pushed the torrent north towards the rocky shoals of Anchor Point. So they got to go up to Anchor Point. And the storm blew up. What did Captain Carleton do? He got drunk. It took the ship 3 days to return to the peninsula's southern tip. And then it gets worse. On the morning of July 15th, 1868, shortly after 7 a.m., the mariners tried to thread the bark through the rocky entrance of Port Graham to the sheltered bight known as Coal Cove. Carleton, apparently hungover, left the mate to steer. And I had to put a note in here. I worked on the Exxon Valdez oil spill. I got such deja vu reading this. It's like, is this reincarnation? The latter became alarmed about the strong currents and the freshening wind, and it was pushing the ship towards the outcrop that the Russians had named Opasny Mis, which happens to translate as dangerous cape. The mate ran below to rouse the captain. Carleton came on deck and ordered his crew to turn the vessel. But the winds and tides, not the men, controlled the ship. Wythe described the scene. Another big quote here from the doctor. Quote, "The yards were hauled, but the ship did not answer to the helm, and we saw that she was doomed. In 2 minutes after the order to tack was given, she struck the end of the reef, stern first, and swinging round, a wave carried her bodily upon the rock, knocking a large hole in her bottom. In a moment, everything was in confusion. The captain's orders were not obeyed. Soldiers and sailors ran about the deck in great excitement. The sails remained set, and the ship rolled fearfully in the white foam of the breakers, striking alternately on the bow and the stern. Every time the ship struck the rock, dozens of men would fall and be carried across the deck. To add to the confusion, the great spanker boom broke loose and thrashed about the quarterdeck at every roll the ship made. It was soon evident that the ship was sinking, and the waves began to break over her amidships. The soldiers made a rush for the lifeboat, which was hanging at the davits, and in a moment it was full of men. Captain McGillivray and his officers threatened to shoot into the crowd if they did not come out. They obeyed very quickly, and with this exception, behaved well. We had a large lifeboat, two ship's boats, and a small yawl, besides two large lighters which were lashed to the forward deck. Good thing. The boats were lowered, the women and children placed in the lifeboat first, and then ordered ashore with as many men as they would hold. In about 10 minutes after striking, the bark went down, but fortunately did not slide off the rock, unquote. Rowing everyone about a mile from the reef to the cove's beach took a couple terrifying hours. All the people and five of the mules survived. With only the wet clothes they wore, the castaways huddled on the beach. Supplies and shelter became the next critical keys to survival. The sailors went back out to collect everything they could reach that was bobbing around on the surface of the water. During the next slow tides, they rowed back to the wreck repeatedly, salvaging part of the cargo. So this is where they landed. The castaways discovered they were not in a trackless wilderness. Above the beach were ramshackle buildings, remnants of the coal miner's outpost abandoned only a few years earlier. In its heyday in 1860, Coal Village had been the third largest settlement in Russian America. But competition undermined efforts to sell Alaska coal to the US West Coast, and the venture went bust. Most buildings already had lost their roofs, but the unwilling visitors bivouacked where they could. The officers worried about food, clothing, and how to get rescued. The people shared scarce blankets and had only the clothes on their back to wear, ranker with each passing day. The unknown risk of attack from local Indians heightened the tension. A small settlement was visible across the water, and that would be near modern Nanwalek. And no doubt the people there would soon discover that the Torrance passengers were essentially defenseless. The day after the wreck, McGillivray sent out Lieutenant John H. Gifford and some sailors rowing a lifeboat in hopes of reaching Kodiak to summon help. 2 days passed, then Gifford and the rowers returned, exhausted and discouraged. They had gotten lost and the lifeboat leaked. The officers came up with a desperate bluff to deter attack. Having enough dry gunpowder and one shell to shoot the functioning cannon once, they resolved to fire it off to signal, falsely, to area natives that they were armed and able to defend themselves. Crawford, remember, he's one of the officers on this boat, in a 1905 interview, so it's many, many years later, described the surprising result. The soldiers fired off their cannon and expected the natives across the bay to head for the hills. To their dismay, instead, the natives ran down the beach, hopped in their bidarkas, and paddled energetically towards the castaways. The officers ordered the men to hide in the bushes, arm themselves with bricks and sticks, and not let the natives see that they were unarmed. McGillivray and Crawford, the only men with working pistols, stood on the beach to face the flotilla. As told in the newspaper story, quote, when the canoes reached about 50 feet from the shore, they drew up in battle line, and the one in the middle, containing the chief, left them and headed for the shore. He was met by Captain McGillivray and Colonel Crawford, and through a Russian soldier with the expedition, they managed to elicit from the Indian the fact that the Russians, who formerly had occupied the island, they thought it was an island, whenever they wanted assistance from the Indians, fired a shot, and they came immediately. When this fact became known, and that the Indians came for no hostile purpose, the officers felt very cheap. But thank their stars that nothing more serious resulted from the visit of the Indians, unquote. Let's see. Yes. Immediately, the two groups negotiated deals. This included hiring swift kayakers to carry the news of their plight to Kodiak. McGillivray paid the Subpiak hunters $100 in gold coins for this. Crawford scrawled this note, which is now at the University in Fairbanks, and I got to see it and take this picture of it. It starts off, quote, "We ran on a rock in trying to get into this harbor on the 15th last and lost everything we had except our lives," unquote. Then it details the situation and asks for rescue. The kayakers proved true to their word. On July 29th, they reappeared, bringing a white fur trader from Kodiak and a letter from Huggins. Remember, he's the commander at the new fort at Kodiak. On August 1st, all the castaways were snugly aboard a rescue ship on the way to Kodiak. On Kodiak, Battery F spent a dreary winter as men and families doubled up with colleagues in hastily constructed quarters. Some, including Dr. Wythe, left Alaska during the interlude. So if this were a play, this would be the intermission. So we've been through the adventures of 1868, and we're now moving on to 1869. So after the shipwreck, Lieutenant Crawford becomes our best source of information. It turns out he preserved a diary and candid personal correspondence, as well as official documents and reminiscences about his Alaska adventures. His descendants, not long ago, donated his papers and photos to the University of Alaska Fairbanks archives, where I got to examine them. So this is a photo of him taken decades later at the end of his career. And this was a gold mine, finding that stuff. When I went to go look at this stuff, the archivist said, "Yeah, we got this not too long ago, and you're the first person to ask to look at it." And I started reading it and went, oh my God. So this is why this talk is happening. Thank you, the ghost of Madoram Crawford. So in the spring, Battery F's remaining personnel shipped north into Cook Inlet again with better directions. They bypassed the Southern Peninsula altogether and arrived at the mouth of the River Katnu, where on April 17th, 1869, they officially established Fort Kinney on the same site as the Russians' Fort St. Nicholas. They had to wait for high tide to get their ship into the river mouth, then carry all baggage and freight up the steep and eroding trail, angling up the face of the bluff to the plateau above. The newcomers found an established settlement far more substantial than the indigenous hamlets of Kachemak Bay, one more like Kodiak. Battery F entered a small but complex community, including Kenaitse families, the Russian Orthodox Church, and one or two, that's unclear, trading posts. West Coast fur traders had reached Alaska far faster than government representatives and inked deals with the mercantile faction of the Russian American Company. By the time the U.S. Army arrived, U.S. merchants already were there. running the trading post in what we now call the town of Kenai were Vladimir Stafeyev, a multilingual holdover from the Russian-American company, and James Wilson, a Scotsman the new owners brought in to deal with English speakers. And we don't have an 1869 photograph of Kenai, but this is 1955. And I believe we are right here now. And here's the old chapel. And it's believed that that was one corner of the fort. Relations with the trading post managers were ambivalent. Crawford's younger brother, Fred, came up from Oregon and got a job as a clerk at the trading post that summer. So you have the two Crawford brothers, one at the fort and one at the trading post. The military records complain that the trading post entrepreneurs gained control of the good buildings and left crumbling ruins for the army. General George P. Irie, who visited Fort Kenai in September of 1869 to inspect the facilities, wrote, quote, "There has been barefaced swindling sufficient in connection with the transfer of the buildings," air quotes, "to make a saint swear. The long and short of the business is, the agent of the Russian Fur Company disposed of the best of the warehouses and residences to HK and Company." So HK was Hutchinson Coal. That was the first name of what eventually became the Alaska Commercial. To HK and Company and to private individuals for a mere song, and then turned over to the agent of the United States the balance, which, with very few exceptions for appearance sake, are fit for firewood only, ugh, unquote. Faced with poor options for shelter, Battery F enlisted men set down their guns and picked up hammers. We don't know exactly where the fort's boundaries were, but the landmark chapel in Kenai's old town is said to mark one corner. The library has microfilm in the archives of all of the surviving official military records from Fort Kenai. And I guess they had a lot of time to work on their penmanship while they were doing this. Faced with poor options for shelter, the Battery F enlisted men set, I already wrote that. Alaskan sources say almost nothing about life at the fort. The soldiers were supposed to show the US flag, impose order, and prepare the way for American settlers. It appears that they found themselves beset by unpleasant food, weather, housing, tedium, and personality clashes. Who were these men? We know a bit about the officers, but next to nothing about the enlisted men. One private's name, however, leaps out at Alaska history buffs. Ivan Petrov appears on the roster, listed as a clerk and translator. So I'm not sure, but he may have been the guy on that beach talking to the chief and the guy but in the Bonarka that day. Many soldiers were, like Petrov, European immigrants. They varied in age. Crawford was only 24, straight out of West Point, when he got to Alaska. McGillivray described one private as too elderly to work. McGillivray had three lieutenants to assist him, Crawford, Gifford, and DeMulin. One priority was outreach to the locals, most of whom were Dena'ina Athabascans, still living in traditional ways. During the first week, Gifford and Crawford hiked over to the village of Shkituqt, later called Kenai Village, and Crawford described it as squalid. At the beginning of May, the two officers visited Ninilchik. Glaring personality differences emerged early. Only 10 days after the fort's official beginning, Crawford journaled about arguing with the unbearable de Meulen. From Italy and trained in art and draftsmanship, de Meulen had an alcohol problem that nearly resulted in tragedy. A month later, in a private letter to his father, Crawford wrote, quote, de Meulen got very tight last night with the priest and got him, meaning the priest, to bed in his, DM's, bed at the fort, and then went to the priest's house and tried to go to bed with his wife, but was hammered nearly to death with a rolling pin and finally slept in a cow house, at least so everyone says, and he has his head pretty badly mashed up today, unquote. And reading that in the university archives is when I decided I needed to bring this story back to Kenai. At the end of July, the fort had its first important visitors, Major General George H. Thomas, nicknamed the Rock of Chickamauga during the Civil War, replaced Halleck and was on an inspection tour of Alaska. He came to Fort Kinney with an aide-de-camp, Alfred L., and I'm not sure which, what rhymes with his last name, Huff, How, whatever, H-O-U-G-H, and that's the guy who wrote the piece that's in that book that's being passed around. At the end of September, the fort hosted its second group of visiting generals. One was Davis, who we saw earlier, and the other, Irie, who, having hit a stretch of fair weather, declared Kenai, quote, the most desirable place to live in I have yet seen in Alaska, unquote. So we got a positive review there from General Irie. Whiskey, illicit or legal, preoccupied the men at the fort, especially Crawford, who ran the commissary. Problems with de Meulen reached a dramatic climax in November. Crawford told his unexpurgated version of events in a letter to his father written shortly after they occurred, and then this is paraphrasing. De Meulen went on another drunken spree. Captain McGilvery arrested him, but he promptly got out and bought more wine, threatening anyone who interfered. De Meulen retired to his quarters and things were quiet until midnight. De Meulen then appeared in the fort's doctor's room and tried to shoot the sleeping man in the head at close range. The drunk was a poor aim and the doctor a light sleeper, who fled the scene. There was a bullet hole in the pillow and another in the door. The doctor immediately reported the attempted murder and soldiers secured de Meulen. McGilvery shipped the fellow off to Kodiak for court-martial and imprisonment. Crawford's letter included a grim assessment of Fort Kinney. Quote, we are of no more use here than we would be on top of Mount Hood, and General Thomas expressed as much when he was here in July, unquote, he wrote. Over time, Battery F saw attrition, turnover, and absences. Men were transferred to Kodiak for duty or released thither for medical or disciplinary reasons. With the new year, McGilvery developed health problems, and in April, he left for California. At the end of May, many of the remaining Battery F soldiers were transferred to Kodiak. Crawford found himself by default commander of the dwindling garrison. He predicted the fort's imminent closure and called it, quote, the most useless of any post probably in the civilized world, unquote. The reports from Alaska convinced officials that the Army presence was expensive and useless. In August, Secretary of War William W. Belknap ordered all Alaska posts except Sitka to close. Stafayev, that's the guy who was at the trading post who was the holdover from the Russian-American Company. And he was, by the way, not Russian, he was Estonian. He penned a scathing letter about the garrison. He described the soldiers as careless arsonists debauching the locals. Quote, "Our Fort Kinney is to be done away with," he wrote in Russian to a friend. Quote, "They are now evacuating half the soldiers and the other remaining half will be moved out in September or October. Then, praise be, life will be peaceful," unquote. At the beginning of September, demobilization was underway. Crawford, as acting commander, recorded the orders. Control of the buildings and other assets would go to Wilson, and goods that could not be transferred were to be distributed free to, quote, "friendly Indians in the vicinity of the fort," unquote. On September 14th, 1870, Crawford turned the facility over to Wilson and left the next day with the rest of the garrison. Fort Kinney had existed for 17 months. Legacies. Fort Kinney's best known impact on the region was to rename the Creole hamlet known as Fort St. Nicholas or Nikolaevsk during the Russian period. The village began appearing on English language maps as Kenai, current spelling. Somehow, the Kenai name also attached to the adjacent river, earlier called by the Dena'ina name Kaknu or Katnu. The most exciting thing to happen to Fort Kenai's reputation in recent decades was the rediscovery of the sunken torrent. Its story interested marine archaeologist Steve Lloyd, who organized a dive team that sailed to Port Graham. In 2006, they located traces of the ship, and with the aid of area residents and the Coast Guard in 2007, salvaged items, including a howitzer intended for the fort. Lloyd made a fine documentary video about that. After stabilization and restoration work, the Alaska State Museum in Juneau added the torrent items to its collection. And I got to see some of the stuff, and this is one of the things I saw. This is Steve Lloyd's picture, not mine, but I'll just sort of end on this note. Perhaps the most significant for science and history was the ship's head, the first documented flush toilet in Alaska. So there you have the brief, inglorious career of Fort Kenai and its legacy. And it's sort of a footnote, so when Lloyd and his volunteers, it was mostly volunteers, when they salvaged this stuff, their intention was to have it go into a local museum, like maybe the Pratt Museum in Homer, and the State Museum in Juneau kind of stole the stuff. It had to go outside into Juneau to have professional restoration, and they've held on to it. So that is the end of the story.
That was Shauna Loshbaugh, Kenai Peninsula historian and longtime Kenai Peninsula resident, sharing her research project, The Brief, Awkward History of Fort Kenai. I'm Jenny Nyman, and this has been the Kenai Conversation on listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.